May it please the Court, Kate Aronson representing Appellant Dordell. The touchstone of due process is the protection of the individual against arbitrary state action. And the issue in this case is not the authority or the discretion of a sentencing judge to impose conditions of probation at the time of sentencing, which seems to be the focus of the state's answering brief, and it's the state's recent citation to the Dahl case. But rather the issue is whether due process requires a defendant to be afforded notice and a hearing before a defendant's conditions of probation are changed or are increased in a way that places a restriction on a defendant's liberty interest. And the critical fact in this case is that Mr. Dordell pled no contest to offensive touching and unlawful imprisonment second degree. The conditions of probation at the time of sentencing was a fine to be paid during the probationary period and no contact with Skyler Brelsford. 5 weeks later, probation unilaterally changed those conditions. Probation reassigned Mr. Dordell from level two to the sex offense division of probation to Officer Ferrara.
Can I interrupt for a second to make sure I understand your position? Would you be here and making an argument today if the change that was undertaken with respect to his restrictions had been done after a hearing before the judge, but still after the sentence?
No. If the defendant has the opportunity to be heard and to challenge what information, if any, probation is relying on in making the recommendation and has an ability to confront witnesses, such as the evaluator in this case that Judge Cooch relied on that was done 2 months or approximately 6 weeks after he was placed on these conditions to justify why he was placed on these conditions, then no.
All right, so eventually your client did get a hearing, didn't he?
He did get a hearing. However, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just trying to be clear on this. Your client got a hearing, got an opportunity to be heard, got due process at that point, correct or not?
I would say no, Your Honor. The reason Mr. Dordell did not get due process at that point is that under Rule 32.1, my client had a right to confront adverse witnesses, and the trial court relied on the hearsay statements of Bob Gingrich, who did the evaluation at probation through the testimony of Officer Ferrara. Specifically, at that hearing, I asked for the opportunity to either postpone it or continue it to give me an opportunity to question Mr. Gingrich regarding the justification as to why he was put on those conditions. But that was still done after. That evaluation was done after.
Sorry, you were not allowed to confront at the hearing that actually took place after the new conditions for probation?
I was not given the opportunity to question Mr. Gingrich, who had done the evaluation of Mr. Dordell, and Mr. Gingrich's opinions were testified to by Officer Ferrara, and there was no written report given to the court or to counsel prior to that hearing or even at the hearing.
And after the hearing, you were not given an opportunity to correct for that. Is that correct?
After the hearing, the lower court requested a status report from probation regarding whether probation considered it necessary to continue the conditions.
But on your concern about not being able to cross-examine Mr. Gingrich, that never happened?
I was never given that opportunity, no.
And you did object to the court at your hearing about?
Yes.
Is it clear that you would have had that opportunity had the sequence prescribed by the statute 4332A been followed?
Well, if probation has submitted a report to the court requesting additional conditions and outlining the basis of the conditions, then counsel certainly would have had the opportunity to subpoena or require or at least prepare for the allegations. In this case, though, it was done without any evaluation whatsoever. Probation made a unilateral decision that he was appropriate for sex offender conditions, handed him the form, handed my client the form in the probation office, and said, sign this. This is a list of the probation conditions you now have. No contact with anyone under the age of 18, no cruising activities, a polygraph examination, and sex counseling. Those conditions, Mr. Dorrell was told that if he did not sign it, it would be reported to the court and considered a violation. So under those circumstances, he signed it, and it was subsequent to the signing of the agreement that actually gave probation the authority to then do the assessment to determine whether or not he was appropriate for that counseling or for that area of probation.
What would have happened had he refused to sign the addendum that he signed on June 24th?
If he had refused to sign, he would have been reported to the court, and Judge Cooch at the hearing accepted that it would be considered a violation and the court would be notified.
Well, and he would have had a hearing?
Yes.
And all the issues that he could raise with due process would be raised at that time?
Correct. However, signing that under the threat of a violation of probation, I would submit, would not be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of any right he may have had. And I submitted yesterday to the court in response to the state's intent to rely on Dahl, the State versus Merriweather case, which is a Tennessee case Tennessee has a statute that tracks the language of our Rule 32.1B. And in State versus Merriweather, the Tennessee Supreme Court held that before probation can be modified, there must be a hearing if that modification would be adverse to the defendant.
That's in the absence of a knowing voluntary consent to a
correct. And the reason I mentioned Merriweather is in that case, the defendant was on probation for bad checks and a period of time to pay restitution. Defendant was unable or did not pay the restitution in that period of time. Probation then handed the defendant a piece of paper that extended indefinitely probation, and if the person didn't sign it, it would be violated, which is exactly what happened in this case. Agree to the extension or the addition of these conditions, or you would be violated. And in that case, the Tennessee Supreme Court, having that statute that tracks the language of our 32.1 Superior Court rule, held that that was a violation of due process.
Keeping in mind, and I'm not discounting your due process argument, but given the caseload of Superior Court, the lack of opportunity to have counsel available at every violation of probation hearing, all the sentences that I recall say you're placed in the custody Department of Correction. And the understanding, at least my understanding, was once that happens, the court doesn't look at it again until there has been a violation of probation, and it's sort of understood that there'll be changes made by the Department of Probation over the period of supervision that's consistent with the change in that person's life. If probation officer comes to defendant and says, I have information that suggests to me that your probation needs to be modified, here's the reason why, here's the form you need to sign in order to be modified, it's going to enhance your restrictions, or it's going to place further conditions upon your lifestyle or whatever. If you don't agree that that should happen and don't sign it, then you'll be violated and you'll go before a judge. Why is that a worse mechanism than one which says before you can modify anybody's probation, you have to notify the court and a person's entitled to a hearing with a right to confront the witnesses against them?
Well, I think there's a fundamental difference between modifying probation or a condition of probation that is consistent with a condition of probation imposed by a sentencing judge. For example, someone is sentenced to substance abuse treatment. The answer by probation is you're more appropriate for Program A versus Program B based on your specific needs.
Right.
That's a different circumstance than without a factual basis or with any determination as to need, imposing conditions that increase the burden on the person or increase increase the sentence.
Well, when you add a phrase like without any facts or without any basis for the need, there was an affidavit here that would have arguably suggested to the probation officer, we need to get a hold of this problem right away and do something about it. And here's the way I'm going to fashion the conditions of probation to do it. I'm going to present it to the defendant. If the defendant agrees, it's an enhanced condition of supervision. If he doesn't agree, we'll take it to the judge and the judge can resolve it. In terms of efficiency, cost-benefit analysis, working within the system with the resources that are available, why doesn't that make sense? I mean, you suggest this is out of the blue, but it wasn't out of the blue. The probation officer just didn't wake up one morning and say, I think I'm going to have Mr. Dordell in and impose another condition on his probation because I don't have 275 clients to deal with today. I'll just pick on him. There was some basis for it. Isn't the question, where do we draw the line, and where do you have to go to the judge first before you can impose a condition?
Yes. Where we draw the line, I think, is the whole crux of this case. When you have a case that's pending for 9 months in the Superior Court with an experienced Deputy Attorney General assigned to the case from the sex unit who pleads the case down to misdemeanors that are not sex offenses, there must be some analysis that has gone into that. So relying solely on the affidavit of probable cause, without the police reports, without all of the other information that's been developed in the case, the affidavit of probable cause could either contain inaccurate information, not all of the information, hearsay, anything that would certainly be an insufficient basis to ratchet someone up and classify them as a sex offender when all of the other information doesn't indicate a need whatsoever. So to increase a condition or a burden on the person, it is a fine line between the burden that's on the court as it is with the number of cases and the violations versus eviscerating totally an independent a person's rights. Once they're on probation, they can be dispensed with as probation pleases.
Well, when you say eviscerate the person's rights totally, get me over this problem where the probation officer says, I'm going to impose this condition of probation. You have to sign off on it. If you don't, you get a hearing before a judge.
If you don't, you get a hearing before a judge, I think, is a different set of circumstances than saying you will be violated and now the burden is on you. As opposed to saying you get a hearing, you either agree to it.
Or has the burden shift? I thought we had cases that say there has to be a factual basis before a person can be violated, and the burden of both proof and persuasion is on the government or on the state.
The burden, then I suspect the question would be, why wouldn't the burden be on the government to demonstrate the need to increase this? And not do it in the context of a violation as though the defendant has, in fact, violated, so to speak, his conditions of probation. When
are you arguing for some kind of administrative hearing process before it gets back to the judge?
No. I'm arguing for a hearing before
the judge. Go directly to the judge.
Correct.
In other words, your system would entail, instead of confronting the probationer with your belief as a probation officer that there needed to be an enhanced condition of supervision, with notice to that defendant, the probation officer would go directly to the sentencing judge and say, I'm requesting a hearing, and at that hearing, the state will establish a need for this enhanced condition of probation.
Yes, and I think that would comply with Section 4332, that the probationer would be on notice as well as...
So the issue becomes not just which is the better way of doing it, but whether doing it the way you've outlined here was a violation of due process.
Correct.
Okay.
Can I ask you, what is it that you're looking for in the way of relief?
Vacation of the conditions of probation.
Permanently?
Yes. That the, or at least remanded for a hearing wherein the defendant would be given an opportunity to confront the witnesses against him. That this Mr. Gingrich be cross-examined as to the basis of his evaluation and the reasons why he determined it.
If the defendant here had been told that we want to enhance the conditions of your probation, we'd like you to agree to it, here's a form, and if you don't, then we'll go to a hearing, that would be one thing. That didn't happen here.
Correct.
In this case, the defendant was told that if you don't sign this, then you will be deemed to have violated your probation.
Correct.
By signing, and the suggestion is that by having it presented to him that way, there was some coercion involved.
Yes.
By signing that document, were the defendant's rights adversely affected? That is, did he was he then at a disadvantage at the hearing that did take place? Did it matter at all legally that he signed the document?
It mattered to the extent that his liberty interest, which was affected by the conditions, it was done without a hearing and without an ability. He had the ability to contest it, but it was only contestable under the possibility of a violation if he didn't agree to it. Certain of the conditions were imposed.
You're saying that he was disadvantaged because by agreeing to it, the best that he got was a post-deprivation hearing.
Correct.
Rather than a pre-deprivation hearing.
Yes.
You're into your rebuttal time if you want to save it.
I would like to save it. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Gregory Smith, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the state. If I may first begin by responding to some of the arguments that have been raised in the opening. First of all, Mr. Dordell received as much process as he was constitutionally due, and in fact more process than the average individual who's actually facing a violation of probation hearing. This Court has ruled numerous times that actually even having counsel at a VOP hearing is not a constitutional requirement.
You're making an argument that was nowhere stated in your brief, isn't that correct?
I'm yes. In responding to arguments right now, yes. I am.
Don't you think that it would have been, since due process was the gist of the other side's position, that it would have been fair to the court to at least respond on the same terms so that we would have whatever authorities bear on this subject before us?
Your Honor, it was my interpretation that this was not, that the way this case was presented was, does the Superior Court have the authority to hand out the sentence that it does, and looking at it as a sentencing decision, and that's how I argued it in my answering brief, that by responding and looking at 4332, the discretion that's given to probation and parole, and by looking at that, then the Superior Court reviews that, and after a hearing where Mr. Dordell is represented by counsel and does cross-examine the probation officer who's sworn that he has received due process, and in fact,
the argument heading. There's only one argument made here.
I agree.
The defendant's constitutional right to due process was violated, and that defendant's liberty was restricted without notice to defendant, a hearing, or justification.
Your Honor, if I misunderstood the way appellant presented this, then I certainly accept responsibility for that. And in terms of the way I replied in my answering brief, I certainly was not trying to sandbag the court or counsel in any way.
And I'm not trying to chastise you professionally or personally, my only concern is that by arguing that the defendant got whatever process was due now, we're not getting the benefit of a well-reasoned writing that has whatever legal authorities may be applicable.
And that is most certainly a fair point, and perhaps I should not have begun by responding off the cuff to what was in my mind raised by the discussions between counsel and the court.
Well, actually, now that you're on that subject, anyhow, I'm curious. What's your position with respect to the fact that Mr. Dordell's counsel was not allowed to cross-examine Mr. Gingrich?
Mr. Dordell certainly was aware of this hearing as it came up, and there's nothing to suggest that he could not subpoena Gingrich as a witness.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe I don't understand the facts. Had Mr. Gingrich performed his analysis at the time of the hearing or not?
And that's part of the confusion in this case, Your Honor. A written evaluation, no. At the time of hearing, it's most definitely not. I guess kind of a brief factual recap is probation and parole receives Mr. Dordell, sees the affidavit of probable cause, bells go off. They say, all right, this is not just a typical offensive touching. Let's refer this to the sex offender unit. When they see that, they decide, you know what, let's get some special conditions. Then at that time, then they do speak with Mr. Gingrich. Gingrich does not at that time file any sort of report. It's solely a verbal exchange. And that's the way the probation and parole officer testified at the evidentiary hearing, that she'd spoken with Gingrich. Gingrich suggested to her that it would be appropriate and that he does not always say, sign off automatically when somebody comes to him.
Okay, but I gather that counsel for Mr. Dordell was anxious to be able to cross-examine Mr. Gingrich and requested that opportunity. Is that correct?
I can't say for certain from the record that's clear to me, Your Honor.
But it's your position on behalf of the state that it was acceptable to have, as the only person you could cross-examine, a probation officer who could report what he was told by the person who was the expert.
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason that's acceptable is the Superior Court's ruling is, I believe, based on the statements, essentially, of the review of the affidavit of probable cause and a limited discussion. The Superior Court didn't make its decision assuming that there was further evaluation beyond a review of affidavit of probable cause. So in that sense, given the factual support for the Superior Court's ruling, a further inquiry into Mr. Gingrich's report at the time isn't really legally relevant to the Superior Court's decision.
So in other words, the Superior Court decided that the conditions were appropriate based solely on the affidavit of probable cause?
Yes, Your Honor.
And because that was the basis for the court's decision, counsel for Mr. Dordell didn't need to be given the opportunity to examine Mr. Gingrich. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in this instance, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Of significant note to this court, there are other instances where individuals are given conditions of probation that do not relate to their underlying offense. Specifically, in the Phoenix and Melody cases, where we have individuals, either burglars or robbers, who are then given either sex offender conditions or given drug treatment. And in neither of those cases is the underlying offense either a sex offense or a drug offense.
But there are facts developed in the course of preparing the case for trial or in pre-sentence investigation or in initial intake with probation that suggest that there's an underlying problem to which resources have to be brought to bear. It's not just willy-nilly, because all those resources are limited, aren't they? So they have to be tailored for the people that really need them.
Most certainly, Your Honor, that as I'm sure the court is.
So the issue here, I suppose, as the trial judge apparently reviewed it, was whether or not probation and parole and balancing the risks of the community should go forward with nothing more than an affidavit before some thorough evaluation of Mr. Dordell and impose conditions that are suggested by nothing more than an affidavit.
That's a fair statement, Your Honor, that's all that probation and parole officers have at the time of the intake. And they have to make decisions based on that, and further evaluations come up after the fact.
The trial judge seemed to say that, well, if it turns out after the evaluation that these conditions are inappropriate, then we'll reduce them or eliminate them.
Correct, Your Honor.
What kind of standard, what kind of predictable, consistent standard could exist throughout the cases from judge to judge if that's the way we want to go out the business of assigning conditions of probation? Let's put them on, and then if they're not necessary, we'll take them off one by one. How much sense does that make?
That's very difficult for me to stand here and
sort
say.
Sort of a rhetorical question, too.
That makes abundant sense, because I can't say that. But given the resources, the way the system works, I'm not sure I can stand up before you and say I have a better way than what we have in place. I kind of like democracy. It's far from perfect, but it's the best system that we have. And
in addition, we understand that the trial judge based its ruling on the affidavit. Does the record show whether the trial judge was influenced in any way by the fact that Mr. Dordell had signed a document consenting to the increased or enhanced conditions of probation?
Your Honor, my review of the record does not suggest that the Superior Court based its ruling on either on a waiver theory, and the state has certainly not presented waiver or consent as the basis for requesting that this court affirm the Superior Court's decision. For the purposes of this argument, we will assume that Mr. Dordell's consent was coerced. That's the position that we've taken in the briefs, and we're certainly not here to argue.
Was that position communicated to the trial court?
Your Honor, I'm not sure exactly. I understand from the Superior Court's ruling that he said, regardless of whether it was coerced or not coerced, his consensual signature, that this is my ruling. I cannot say to you. I certainly can say that during the probation officer's testimony, she emphasized that he signed it. But in my review of the transcript, I can't say to you that the state.
You can't say what role, if any, the having signed that document played in the decision that was reached by the trial judge.
No, Your Honor. As the court is certainly aware, there is an enormous volume of individuals placed on probation, and Mr. Dordell accepted being placed on probation when he pled no contest and then was convicted of two crimes. He knew that Section 4332 was out there, that probation and parole has broad discretion at the time of his plea. There's no suggestion that his initial plea to these two crimes was not knowing and voluntary. It's the question that then comes up is, how much is a defendant who is accepting a plea reasonably expected to know? Does the Deputy Attorney General who is formulating a plea have to put every conceivable change of conditions of probation into that plea in order for it to be valid? Or otherwise, the defendant can say, I didn't comprehend that this would be a possible ramification of my guilty plea. That's an enormous amount to expect, given the volume of cases. And it's a burden that's not constitutionally required and would essentially grind the system to a halt if that were imposed. If the justices have no further questions, then I waive the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may quickly clarify, the trial judge did rely on the evaluation that was done subsequent to signing the conditions and the implementation of the conditions, and that's found at the page 39 in the transcript of the hearing. In this case, I think it's critical that there never was a pre-sentence investigation, that the state made the determination based on the information that it had to plead these charges down to the misdemeanors that were not sex offenses, that there was no indication by the state, who never sought these conditions, that they were necessary or appropriate. And probation has made the unilateral decision to oppose them. And I think the state's argument in part is, if you plead to a charge, you are in the hands of probation, and probation can do what they want with you. And it's fundamentally, I think, in violation or goes against the due process right, that if you're going to increase a sentence or impose a burden on a person, that they have the right to be heard and confront the witnesses against them.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. Stand in recess.
Please rise.